Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer Bob Prohl. Prohl was the 2012 New York Foundation for the Arts Fellow in Fiction and a 2013 resident at the Saltonstall Arts Colony. He has written for the 33 and a Third book series and worked as a columnist and reviewer for the arts and culture site PopMatters.com. This month, he releases his wonderful debut novel, 100,000 Worlds. It was published by Viking. Prohl has also worked as a bookseller and program director for Buffalo Street Books and as a DJ, record store owner, and bartender. And welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, as I said, you've had varied jobs, many interests, but did you know you always were going to write a novel?
I mean, it's something that I've always worked at. I don't know that I always knew it was something I could try to make a living at. And I had gotten some positive feedback on work. I had gotten the NIFA Fellowship and the residency at Saltonstall, which is where I wrote the first draft of this book. And coming out of that, I was working at the bookstore at the time, and my wife and I sat down, and she said, look, if you're going to make a go of this, take a year and make a go of it. And so I left my job and sat down to doing rewrites on this book, and sort of things fell into place very, very quickly from there. I was really lucky in the way things worked out.
Was this particular book and these particular characters and these landscapes, was this brewing in you for many years?
It was. I wrote the draft in 2013, but I had the first couple chapters as early as 2010, I think. And it was just, it seemed at the time like such a big project that it was always going to be, it kept being the next thing that I was going to do. And I actually wrote a whole other book that is just going to sit in a drawer forever, and then an early draft of something else that is also sitting in a drawer before I kind of sat down and said, okay, this is the project that I've got to work on now.
Yeah. Wow, it's a fantastic book. It was really fun. The characters are varied and fascinating, and there's so many different landscapes and cultures in it. Were you always interested in the comic book world? I mean, that's the thread that runs through the book, so...
Right. I've been a comic book reader since I was in my early teens, probably a little before that, around the time that Superman died. You know, it was getting all this media coverage, and I came into it in a weird way, is that I was a baseball card collector, which is this weird, even as a kid, it's this weird speculator thing. You're like, this is worth $5, and this one is, you know, but now it's worth $7. And when DC Comics killed off Superman, there was all this talk that it was going to be this huge collector's item, which, of course, it wasn't because there were zillions of them printed.
Yeah, yeah.
But I, like, badgered my dad to take me to the comic book store to pick this thing up so that I could, you know, someday sell it. And instead, I read it. And, you know, one of the great things about comics is that it's a constant state of to be continued. It's, you know, it's a very long-form serial narrative. So I read this comic book, and you get to the end, and it's like, continue next week. And so the next week, I was like, Dad, you got to take me back down there.
Do you remember what the first comic was that captured your imagination like that?
It was that Superman book. I mean, I had read a lot of stuff before, but it was just kind of catch-as-catch-can and whatever was lying around. But yeah, it was around that time, and from there into Batman and X-Men. And then as I got a little older, comic books, there was a section of comic books that were starting to gear themselves more towards mature readers and moving away from superhero stuff into stuff that was a little more heady, a little more cerebral.
A little more gritty, too. I mean, I've even read some, you know, comics have turned into all kinds of things, including, you know, talk about history. You think about the Mouse books. And so you clearly have gone to comic book conventions because you write so beautifully about it in this book, and it's so vivid. To tell us about some of those experiences.
Well, you know, once I had gotten into comics as a kid, even back then when they were cheaper, it becomes kind of an expensive habit. So I actually took a summer job working for a comic book dealer back in Buffalo where I grew up. And his name was Don Puff. He was a World War II veteran. He had lost an eye at Iwo Jima, and he had like this amazing collection of Golden and Silver Age comics, you know, like really old, really valuable stuff. But he also stocked new comics. And so he would go to, they weren't comic book conventions, they were comic book shows, which is basically a smaller version of the same thing. And I would just kind of carry the boxes around for him out to like the malls in the suburbs of Buffalo and sit there and help him with sales. So now, as an adult, I've gone to some of the regional conventions and Ithacon and the River, the one in Elmira that the name is escaping me. And I've been to New York City Comic Con a couple times, which is a much bigger, arguably, attendance-wise, the biggest one in the country. And that was where this idea really started to take shape, was walking up from Times Square to the Javits Convention Center and seeing sort of this fandom like rise out of the general population. You know, you get closer and closer to the convention center and there's just more and more people in superhero T-shirts or in costumes. And
that part
is so great. It's
like a whole world that I didn't even know existed.
It is a tiny little world, all of these. And it's really just, it's such a positive, and there are downsides to it, but it's such a positive space to be in, and it's so great to be in a space where you can unabashedly be really enthusiastic about these stories that you love.
Yeah, and people don't make fun of you that an adult still likes superheroes, right? Let's talk about the two main characters in the book, sure. Valerie and her son, Alex. To tell us about them. They're beautifully crafted, I think.
Well, thank you. Well, Valerie is a former actress on a sci-fi television show, and she has left that world 6 years before the book starts under circumstances that we sort of find out later. And when that happened, she split up with her husband and co-star and took their child and ran away to New York and kind of dropped out. And this is her returning to Los Angeles. She's making appearances at comic book conventions, sort of doing signings and photo ops with fans, which is a big component of conventions. And she's bringing her 9-year-old son, Alex, with her. And we sort of, as the book goes on, it becomes more and more clear that there's something that she's not telling him that he's sort of aware of in that weird, savvy way that 9-year-olds can have, but not quite catching on to.
Yeah.
And so it's really seeing their dynamic and how that changes and how they move apart and move together and how strong that tether between a mother and a child is.
Yeah, it's a really, really, really nice portrait. Now, they go across country to Los Angeles. Have you ever taken that drive? Because it's kind of a vivid picture that you draw.
Did you ever go
to Los Angeles? You drew that pretty well,
I've been very briefly to Los Angeles. I have taken the cross-country drive, but I bucked north after Chicago. We were headed to Seattle when I did that drive. I've been to Los Angeles for about 8 hours. I was in San Francisco. I had taken the train to San Francisco from Ithaca and driven down Highway 1.
Ah.
And then when I got to L.A., there was a bomb scare at the train station, which is where the rental car place was. So I was just circling and driving around in Los Angeles traffic for about 4 hours.
So the Los Angeles of your book was part of your imagination, but everybody has seen so much of Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's
movies
one of those,
and books. And,
you know, it's like New York in that way, that even if you haven't been there, you've seen it. And I checked with friends on specific things. Uh-huh. You know, like it was really important to me that I find a Chinese restaurant that they would have been ordering from on set.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I got in touch with a friend of mine who'd been there, and she's like, oh, they would have gone to this place.
So the little boy, Alex, who's 9 years old, it also gets caught up in wanting to write a story, you know, with superheroes. And to tell us about that, where did that come from? Is he based on somebody that you knew, or is it on you as a kid?
Well, at the time, my stepson was 8 when I started working on this.
Ah.
And so it's tough to say that Alex in the book is based on him, but a lot of the beginning thoughts they're very different kids. Certainly now, my stepson is 13 and he's a completely different kid, but even at the time. And I think that was what really interested me about using a child character is the way that they think and the way that they interpret things, the way they perceive other people's emotions, the way they perceive their own emotions or experience their own emotions, and the way they interact with and generate stories. So in the book, as they leave New York, a friend of theirs gives Alex this sort of seed of a story, which is that there's a boy and a robot in a cave, and it sort of germinates in his head, and he collaborates with Brett, who is a comic book artist in his mid-20s, who's sort of going through that mid-20s, should I get a real job crisis that one goes through if one is engaged in creative pursuits, still engaged in creative pursuits
exactly,
at that age.
Especially in this country, yeah. So the little boy, I thought, seemed really realistic because I've worked with kids, you know, fourth and fifth grade, 9, 10 years old. And I was thinking it was a mini Bob, you know? but, and because it seems so realistic, the way that kid would rationalize things, the way he would imagine things. And that story that he wrote was great. The story he started creating was really interesting, I thought.
Yeah, it was a fun character to write. You know, it's always interesting to write with certain limitations, and using a child as your point of view character does that, and it forces you into that headspace when you start out, you're writing things, and then you'll say like, oh no, what, he wouldn't have that thought. Mm. That's too mature of a thought for a 9-year-old. And sooner or later, you start internalizing those controls, and you start to get this voice that, you know, all those limits become sort of built in, and you start getting a voice that comes out feeling true and feeling like it works for a character of that, a kid of that age.
Yeah, well, we've all been through that age too, so I mean, that helps. Was it difficult for you to put your head inside the women characters? Because you do craft some really nice women characters. They seem realistic. So many novels I read, the men don't know what they're talking about. You know, they don't. They're like empty vessel characters,
yeah,
some of them.
It,
but yours aren't.
It wasn't. And I'm not a super masculine dude. And especially when it came to thinking about parenting, which is, you know, a lot of what Belle is grappling with in the book, I wasn't really interested in the traditional fathering aspects of that. And I'm still not. You know, I'm a step-parent and a parent now. And it's just, that's not a role that appeals to me. It's like I knew very early on that that's not the kind of parent I was going to be. So when I started working on the book, there are kind of two things you could do. You can write the character as male and then go through and then have to keep explaining, well, he's not a traditional male and this is what...
Uh-huh.
And I was like, actually, it's easier and makes more sense for me to take this on as with a female character. And it was really, it was closer to where I was at in thinking about a lot of these things were more maternal, or more what would traditionally be called maternal.
Yeah. And then that's the job of a novelist, too, to be able to put your head inside your characters' lives and stuff. Because Val's ex-husband does seem like a macho, typical male, you know?
He was a very difficult character, right?
He was not very likable at all.
He got more likable in later drafts. He was sort of not like a mustache-twirling villain, but he was a very cardboard cutout character in the first draft. And my editor really pushed me to make him more sympathetic.
Mm. He became a little bit more sympathetic, but he reminded me of the typical L.A., not really that famous, but thinks he's... you know, full of himself kind of guy.
I mean, she never wanted me to make him lovable, but the reader had to, you know, have some sort of investment in the character.
Yeah.
And it was tough to write. It was tougher to write than, you know, writing the whole rest of the book from a mother's point of view. It's this sort of detached father. It was really difficult to find a point of empathy with.
Yeah, well, it seemed very realistic to me, you know. I mean, I felt some sympathy for him as the book went on, but he seemed realistic, so that was fine with me. Have you ever thought about creating comic books and superheroes?
I would love to. I recently, DC Comics has a writing, like, sort of a writing workshop program that they just started, and I applied. I don't know why I applied, but...
Because you want to write comics.
Yeah. I think it would be neat. I'm not a super visual writer. Like, I'm not... You know, I talk with other writers, and one of the questions I always ask is, like, do you see pictures of these things in your head that you... You know, like, are you watching a movie that you're describing to the reader? And for some people, that's how process works for them. And it's not that way for me. Like, I'm much more auditory. I'm much more... hearing sentences and hearing voices. And comic books is such an intrinsically visual medium that it would be a big jump. And yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bob Prohl. We're talking about his wonderful debut novel, 100,000 Worlds. Now, it seems to me you traveled an unusual route to get this book published. You don't have an MFA. You didn't take that route where you have all these contacts from colleges and stuff. So was this a tough road for you these last few years to even get attention?
Not with this book. I feel like before I say how easy it was to find a home for this book, I should say that there was another book that I shopped around really extensively, and I wrote to probably 60 agents, including the person that ended up representing me for this book, and got nothing. And it was like a year or 2 years of of pounding the pavement and cold calling agents with nothing to show for it. This one I wrote to three agents. The second one picked it up like a week after I had written to him initially. Hmm. And I think 2 weeks later we had offers. And that's the thing with that whole process is it's only got to work once, you know, and you just kind of, you have to be persistent with it and something will click, hopefully.
Yeah.
And I was really lucky. That said, I did have, you know, I had contacts through the bookstore and through Ithaca. My agent also represents Taya Obrett, who was Cornell MFA and wrote The Tiger's Wife while she was here in Ithaca. And she was the one that put us in touch.
Yeah, so you did have connections, but they were non-traditional, you know, I must say. I know so many people who go get their MFAs and they have connections through all their professors and published writing professors. And so this gives people hope that you don't have to go that traditional
route. I hope so. I mean, you know, it is partly a matter of getting lucky, but it's also partly a matter of putting yourself in a position where if lightning strikes, you're there to get hit by it.
Mm-hmm.
And and I think that's sort of how I justify it to myself rather than like.
Well, you know, you say that the other book that you tried to sell didn't sell, but this one did. But didn't you decide that you just have to love the work no matter what?
Or
did you think you'd be a failure if you hadn't gotten it published?
I mean, I still love that other book. It'll never, ever be published. It was, it included stuff about technology and social media. And unless, like, 2010 becomes something that you can write a period piece about, this book is never getting published. And I liked it. It's a fun book. But this one felt different. And I think part of that was the way that it was written. I mean, writing something at a residency for a month where you're just kind of almost alone in the woods mm-hmm. with the book really changes your relationship with what you're working on. You know, yeah. It's very different from something that you write when you get home from an 8-hour shift at a job and, you know, write until you fall asleep.
So you really have to make a commitment to. That's what I find, you know, with anything that you want to do in the arts, because you're not normally going to get paid well or get many accolades
right.
from what you do. Well, what do you think attracts adults to these comic book worlds and conventions and stuff? It seems like it's permeating the culture even more. I read more about it.
I mean, for one thing, it's big business right now. But as far as what appeals, for me, certainly it's almost a continuity thing. I mean, it's something that has been part of my life for such a long time. It's like a hard habit to break. It's like drinking coffee. Actually, probably started around the same time.
So you felt like it was an addiction. It's an addiction in some ways, huh?
It is a bit of an addiction. I mean, that's the hook of serial narrative. You know, uh-huh. that's how people end up watching soap operas for 15, 20, 25 years.
Exactly, yeah.
So there is that, the serial nature of it, the to-be-continued nature of it. But I think there's something, you know, in good superhero comics, there's something sort of aspirational that you don't always get in literature.
Mm.
You know, literature is very often about more fundamentally flawed characters, but superheroes offer something else, something to sort of aspire to, a better version of ourselves or yourself. And there's something comforting about that.
Yeah.
It is, and I think it is a bit of comfort food.
Yeah, I would say that too, especially in this culture right now. I mean, I wish we did have a superhero who would come down and save us from some of the stuff that's going on.
Yeah,
it's not really an escape, though. You know, I mean, a lot of people have said to me, "Oh, those people that read comic books, they're just into escape." I don't think so now, and I learned more from your book, so it changed my mind a little bit.
I don't think it's escapism, and I think it's different for a lot of different people. I think for a lot of people, it's empowering. You know, I've talked to people that have used superhero comics to recover from trauma.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things that are offered. And the other thing for me is just the scope and the large-scale imagination stuff that's going on is great and is something that you don't really find. Even superhero movies can't do stuff on the scale of comic books because you basically, you know, you say to a writer, here you go, you have these toys to play with, you have no special effects budget, so sky and past that is the limit.
Yeah.
And, you know, a really good comic book writer and an artist can do stuff in that medium that can't really be found in any other one.
You know what I thought about your book, too? Because you've worked in bookstores and as a DJ and all these various jobs, it seems to me that you were comfortable in this book. You know, I read a lot of writers who are worried about whether they're crafting it right. You know what I mean? It seems like you're comfortable in all these worlds, you know?
Yeah.
Do you think it's because of some of those varied jobs that you've had? And you've met so many different people that way, I'm sure.
I think so, yeah. I think, not to knock MFA programs, but I really worry about kids coming right out of, you know, doing the BFA to MFA track.
Yep.
And, yeah, there's a benefit to having some jobs and, you know, seeing a little bit of life in there. And it also, like, it changes the way you work and it grounds you in writing as work rather than writing as play. Mm-hmm. And I can look at stuff that I did, you know, I would never want to look at stuff that I wrote in my early 20s, but if I was forced to, it would probably be stuff that is more pure play and lacks the sort of a discipline that honestly, like a 9-to-5 job helps with that.
Yeah, it really is a craft as well as an art. A lot of people forget that. It takes a lot of work. I've talked to so many novelists. Now, are you a member of a book group? How did you get this book together? You know, I mean, people have their friends read. You have people helping with editing before the big pros get at it. What did you do?
Well, like I said, with this, the first draft was written almost entirely in seclusion at Saltonstall. And then when it was in rewrites, I had a writing group that I was working with that would see some chapters. And the great thing about them is that, in addition to the fact that they're just fantastic people, is that I was really worried that this book would be too closed off. You know, I was talking about a subculture that I'm a part of, and I was worried that to somebody who wasn't into comics, this would just, there'd be no hook, that or that it'd be off-putting, or that it would be a bunch of in-jokes, and I really wanted to avoid that. So it was great to have a group of 4 or 5 people, depending on how many showed up in a given month, that had no experience with comic books. And I could say, like, does this make sense to you, A? And is this boring the heck out of you, B? And so they were really helpful in getting the sort of later drafts together.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, because when I first heard about this book, I thought, I'm not interested at all in this stuff. I hope he can hook me. And you did. So you did something right for those of us who, it's an alien world to me. And I got hooked. So I thought it was really interesting. I'm interested in subcultures and the different ways people live their lives. So it fascinated me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that idea of subculture is something that I will probably keep coming back to. But it was really natural to me to start with this one.
Uh-huh.
And it's made for really interesting sort of hand-wringing on the marketing side of things. You know, the publisher has sort of gone back and forth on where to put it.
You know what? I was going to ask you that. Are you comfortable with the genres that books have to be put into? Literary fiction, chick lit.
Do you know what it's filed as?
Summer reading, or, you know.
It's filed as women's fiction.
It is?
Yeah.
Well,
I think it's primary. It's like top level. I don't totally understand how these things work, but the top level Amazon classification, I believe, that they decided on was women's fiction.
So fiction for women.
Yes.
Because I was thinking women's fiction means it's written by a woman, right? I mean,
I would think so too.
That
but
is the strangest thing I've ever heard. Really?
Yeah.
My question was, are you comfortable with books being put into boxes like this? That doesn't seem fair.
It's, you know, it is entirely a marketing thing. And certainly coming into it as a new novelist, it's not as big a concern. I think now working on a second book, it becomes a concern because you know more about those boxes. And like the marketing team is already sort of in your head tapping you on the shoulder as you're writing. I don't love it. And I'm someone who is pretty Catholic in their reading and doesn't pay a lot of attention to, and you know, there are some times that I walk into a bookstore and think I really want a sci-fi novel or I really want a mystery novel, and you know, on those days it's great, but I'm also the kind of person that looks at certain books in those sections and it's like, why isn't that in general fiction or vice versa? There's more and more, it feels to me that there's more and more crossing over, particularly out of literary fiction and into genre, or people who are considered literary fiction authors who are experimenting with with genre stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, a lot of those books, a lot of them are really great. Some of them fail because they fail to appreciate the good things about the genre they're playing with.
Yeah.
You know, there are a couple
and
books
And they get stuck in genres that they might not, you know, there's several different categories they could probably go in, right? I mean...
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's fine as long as people keep a sort of higher level view of it and know that just because something says sci-fi on the cover doesn't mean that it's not for you.
Yeah. I remember years ago, you know, I worked in a LGBT bookstore in San Francisco years ago, and there was fiction, and then there was about six books in the lesbian fiction section. You know, and that's when women start saying, hey, I don't want to be categorized like this. This isn't fair. You know, we should just be in with the fiction.
Yeah.
So that it's interesting that we're still debating that issue.
Yeah, I mean, I'm... look, you know, at the end of the day, like, I'm a straight white male, so I get to go in all of the, you know, I get to get filed wherever. I think
yeah,
if I
yeah.
were in a different position, I could imagine it being much more of a concern, whether that would be as a genre author, as a strict genre author who wanted to get out of that, or as someone who's classified as a female author rather than, mm-hmm. you know, just an author. So, yeah, like, I luck out in that regard.
Yeah, and you just—I mean, people are going to read fiction, so I wouldn't worry that much. I've talked to a lot of writers who they don't like this marketing aspect of their books. Have you been told you have to tweet, you have to write a blog every day, you have to do all this stuff to connect with your readers?
Luckily, I don't have to blog. I am like required by contract now to spend half an hour a day on Twitter. And it's not
you have to talk about the book, huh?
No, I'm not. I wasn't. Now that we're getting closer, I have to talk more about the book. But it was more like, you need to engage with comic book writers and other writers and other booksellers. And it was like laying the groundwork for it. And Twitter is such a concise medium, and I am not a necessarily concise person. So it's been a little bit of torture to like start thinking in 140 characters.
Uh-huh. Well, Bob, we're almost out of time. Are you working on anything now that we might expect in the year or so? Or?
I am finishing up, hopefully, a draft of a new book. It's historical fiction, which is a huge jump from this book. It's set in late 19th century Poland in Warsaw under the Russian Empire.
Wow.
Which all of Poland, or that portion of Poland was at the time. And it's about... it was illegal at the time in Poland to educate women past, like, high school age. And Poland has a long-standing academic tradition. And so this group of women formed a secret college called the Floating University that educated women post-high school. And one of their students was actually Marie Curie, who grew up in Warsaw before.
Oh, God, what an ambitious... It sounds fascinating. I hope you managed to finish it up for us.
I hope my editor finds it fascinating.
Well, we are almost out of time. Contact information, your blog, I mean your website?
BobProhl.com, and I'm on Twitter at BobProhl.
Okay, well, Bob Proehl, thank you so much for joining us. Again, his debut novel is called 100,000 Worlds. Go out and get it. It is out now. Thank you, Bob, for joining us.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.